Once we come into consciousness of this great truth, all the most important questions that trouble mankind take on a totally new appearance. Then, and then only, can satisfactory solutions of ancient and perplexing problems be got at. The very atmosphere in which these answers have to be worked out will be wholly changed. We shall be compelled, whether we like it or not, to force the old queries into new shapes, because the standard of reference will now be far other than it hitherto was. Here the student of philosophy finds the actual value of his studies and gets his reward in the awakened insight which shows him how to act rightly, wisely and well. The philosopher could never be a failure in life, however much he might fail in fortune. Philosophy is meant not only to interpret the world, but also to better it, for it pursues ideas through to their practical conclusion. Social or personal idealism must be related to an attainable goal, otherwise it will be harmful. Philosophy provides drifting men with a compass. Hence it is as much for those who are conscious of the absence of any principle of ethical guidance in their lives as for those who seek pure knowledge. They will find philosophy of the greatest help in reaching right decisions at the demands of practical life. What, in the whole range of human culture, could be more useful than this? There is no minute of the day when we are not engaged in doing something or thinking something, and this process goes on all through our waking life. It is an endless and incessant activity. The problem whether what we are doing or what we are thinking is right or wrong, best or worst, that is to say the problem of ethics, is one of the most fundamental and most important we can raise. There are two questions which face every man every day. They are: what is the right way for me to act? And what is the right thing for me to seek? Several other problems are involved in and hinge on this single problem of what constitutes the duty of man. Some of them are: A. What is my highest duty as against my immediate duty? The intrinsic as against the instrumental. B. What is the justification for accepting the notion that there is such a thing as duty and that it is not the creation of human fancy? C. What is the standard of measurement which permits me to grade duties on any scale? All these, however, are philosophical problems. This indicates that pure philosophy does have the most practical bearing on life. And whatever a man sets up as right or wrong is the conscious or unconscious reflection of his conscious or unconscious philosophy of life. His general view of the universe, that is to say his conscious or unconscious philosophic view, supplies him with a standard to mark out or to test either duty or desire. When it applies itself to conduct, philosophy is less concerned with laying down particular rules than with laying down foundational principles. It cares less for little legal clauses and more for large ways of living. Human conduct is ordinarily governed by desire. All desires, emotions, passions, energies, longings, sympathies and antipathies begin to regulate themselves when we understand them better, when we understand ourselves better and when we understand the world better. The value of this study in restoring emotional balance may be expressed in such physical terms as these. It normalizes blood pressure and beneficially regulates glandular secretions. Still more, it harmoniously integrates the neurophysiological functions. It disciplines passions, overcomes bad habits and eliminates nervous fears. It tranquilizes the heart, puts reason into the head and purpose into life. It is of special value to kings, rulers, presidents, ministers of state and governmental chiefs, and to a lesser extent to professional men such as physicians, lawyers, educators and business executives. The benefits received affect both the personal and professional sides of life. It is a misapprehension, however, to imagine that the philosopher epilogue, the philosophic life, must be an acolyte of asceticism, a votary of life negation, utterly remote from human interests and human enjoyments. There is no room in true philosophy for the incurable antinomies of the ascetic hedonistic conflict. The narrow ascetic denies life and views the world as a treacherous trap. But the philosopher finds it a useful school wherein he learns much and lives understandingly. Experience does not merely offer him theoretical food for thought but also practical training for wisdom. Nevertheless, Cupid and cupidity need to be well reined. Every sensible man who wants to fortify his life is indeed something of an ascetic. The power that self-restraint give his mental, ethical and physical character helps him in every way. And when such a man betakes himself to the quest of truth, he will need even more of this inner strength. The flabby weakling who yields to every impulse does not know the delight of being independent, the satisfaction of being in bondage to nothing. But such sane restraint is never to be confused with the unhealthy and unnatural total rejection of everything human. We are here to live and not to run away from life. We must find a way of existence that is reasonable and balanced, not fanatical and remote. Anything overdone is a mistake. A good overdone generates a fresh evil, a virtue overdone creates a new vice. The philosopher is not afraid of any facet of life. He makes the contradictory the complementary. That is why he does not need to run away from the world like the ascetic. Whatever running away he deems necessary is done secretly inside his heart and is not publicly advertised by donning the colored robe of the monk. No amount of world desertion will lead to wisdom in his view, because he knows that he was put into the world to learn its lessons. Nevertheless, he is at one with the monk in wishing to be free from enslavement to desires and in seeking dominion over his own emotions. Beyond this, he cannot travel with the fanatical ascetic. His chief effort being directed towards the control of thought and disciplining of the intellect, its success will reward him with the ability to pass through comfort and discomfort with sufficient detachment to keep his mind unruffled and provide him with the power to work amid the intense hustle of any environment without any loss of inner calmness. Ascetic life is a good and necessary beginning. But when it congeals into rigidity, frigidity and a profession, it is an imperfect end. The wise man is not afraid to endorse the generous and excellent lines of Terence: "I am a man, nothing pertaining to humanity is agent to me." He will move untempted amid the fretting tide of a city's crowds, where he is needed, whilst the fearful hide in caves. He will keep his serenity amid labor or leisure, for his ascetic abandonment is hidden deep within the mind. He will not need to crush out human affection in order to crush out human egoism. He will not need to ignore the treasures of art or fail to respond to the charms of nature in order to maintain emotional equipoise. But the problems of action and conduct do not exhaust man's concern with society and the world. He seeks also to beautify both. Thus art is born. Philosophy has also to find a place for it, and to consider its contribution to the whole. Art indeed is fuel for the philosophic enterprise. Why is it that man feels drawn to music, painting, architecture, poetry, drama and the other arts? What is this beauty which lures man on through his lesser loves? Is the culture of artistic sensitivity a stage on his quest? Those who imagine that philosophy isolates man from all that is warm and beautiful in life are mistaken. The fragrance of white jasmine gives him pleasure as much as it does to others. The ravishing beauty of the sun dying in a great ball of fire does not leave him unaffected, and the tender voice of a violin is not meaningless to him. He is different from other men in this, that he keeps always moored to the higher viewpoint which places these experiences where they belong and does not permit them to overwhelm him utterly. The work of the genuine artist is primarily an imaginative one. He is entitled to call himself a creative artist to the extent that he can carry out an original work in his first available medium, imagination. If he can work only in his second medium, that is to say merely copy photographically in paint, wood, stone, word or sound what others have thus created, we call him a talented artist, but not a creative one. Indeed, competent critics have gone so far as to separate both classes, refusing to dignify the unimaginative with the title of artist and calling him but a workman. There are usually authentic indications in the works of genius to show the profundity of its imaginative power. Yet the imagination itself is nothing else in the end than a tissue of mental pictures, that is, of thoughts. Mozart, who was a genius even as a child, described the process of his experience of musical composition in a brief but illuminative sentence: "All the finding and making only goes on in me as in a very vivid dream. In this self-created world, the artist must make himself at home so completely and so absorbedly that he will resent the coming of mealtimes as a disturbance and the coming of friends as an intrusion. This is why Balzac locked himself in a room literally night and day. When he epilogued The Philosophic Life, wrote those wonderful novels, he was as much in a state of semi-trance as any Indian yogi. That Balzac well understood the mystical character of his art is attested by his own utterance: "Today the writer has replaced the priest. He consoles, condemns, prophesies. His voice does not resound in the nave of a cathedral, it spreads thunderously from one end of the world to the other. For the production of genuine art is nothing less than the practice of genuine yoga. The artist is on a perfect level with the mystic, only he seeks memorable beauty where the latter seeks memorable peace. Inspiration simply means that the artist is so carried away by a series of ideas that for the time being their reality dominates him completely. For him, thought has temporarily become what is felt to be the real. In this respect, the artist is a veritable mystic. Both come to acquire a fervent faith in the reality of their mental constructions. Both arrive unconsciously at the truth of mentalism through the same avenue: intense concentrated self-absorption in a single dominating idea or a single series of thoughts. Both are in the end conscious, semi-conscious or unconscious believers in mentalism. The painter Whistler saw great beauty on the mist-covered River Thames, shrouding its sturdy barges and rat-ridden wharves and raucous steam tugs. This really means that the beauty saw was contained within his own mind. The artist who would attain to the front rank of creative genius must be a mentalist. He must be a believer in this subtle and refined doctrine, which is fit only for subtle and refined temperaments. Were he otherwise, he would be false to his own experience and blind to its implicit meaning. We hear often of the enthralling ecstasy wherein he creates his work and of the moody melancholy which succeeds it later. He walks on air for a while but then treads the earth with leaden feet, regretting that he did not know how to hold his high mood, how to retain it. Let us not envy him. For he pays heavily for his ecstasies. He pays for them in the coin of gloomy moods and black depressions. There are two explanations, two causes to account for this fact, to be found in all the biographies of genius. The first is that during creative work he forgets himself, loses his eye utterly, because it is only by perfect concentration that he can accomplish perfect work. If he cannot forget his ego, then he cannot concentrate perfectly, hence cannot become a perfect artist. Or else he unites in feeling with his prospective audience, that is, merges his individuality in others, and thus loses his ego for another cause. The second is that the briefer pleasure he derives from those precious minutes when he is absorbed in his imagination is the same that his audience will later derive, when beholding or experiencing the finished product of his work. But if this second fact means anything at all, it means that at the precise moment of inspired production by the artist or of engrossed reception by the audience, both are or should be utterly immersed in the world of imaginations. At this sacred time they find thought to be as important and as real as they had heretofore regarded the material world of their own belief. Moreover, in the artist's yearning to find perfect expression of his ideas in paint or on paper, he is unconsciously seeking to break down the fancied barriers between thought and thing, between mind and matter. He is, in short, striving to construct a second idea which shall be a perfect copy of his first one. We may now understand why the artist suffers when his creative mood passes away. For it is then that, psychologically, he lapses back into the ordinary egoistic state and the ordinary unconcentrated state. The contrast is as striking as that between black and white and affects his emotions accordingly. These are some elementary lessons which philosophy teaches in regard to art. The doctrine of karma. Because of its neglect of the primal fact of mind being the ground that supports all else in human life, the scientific culture of the last century found itself in the position of an ethically dangerous materialism which made man into a mechanically manipulated biped. Although the front rank scientists themselves are now emerging from this materialistic phase, the onslaughts of their predecessors have seriously damaged the fabric of religious authority and greatly weakened the strength of religious influence. The popularization of science in the West has made the masses less amenable to the checks and disciplines offered by religion. Moreover, the aftermath of all WTAs has often been a decay of religious faith and an indifference to codes of morality. We are therefore approaching a period when the chief social justification of religion, its power to restrain the conduct of the masses within certain limits, will be definitely impaired. The example of Russia's violent rejection of organized religion following war and revolution is a phenomenon to be calmly and dispassionately considered. It is not to be enthusiastically admired by the irresponsible and unbalanced, nor to be violently denounced by the reactionary and unteachable. For we face a period when the decay of moral sanctions, the loosening of social ties, the lowering of individual standards and the general inclination to unsettle and disturb society combine to constitute an ethically dangerous epilogue, the philosophic life situation. Those who care for human welfare should understand that to apply antiquated sanctions which have lost much of their force will not meet this situation satisfactorily. Religion will be unable to avoid the straight issue and will do better for humanity and for itself if it faces the problem with courage and common sense. Its contribution is always needed, but it ought to be a right one. Every institutional orthodox religion can save itself from the crisis whose preliminary rumbles herald its approach, and even effectively expand its influence, if, first, it will have the courage to cast bad custom behind if need be and find a better life for man, and if, second, it will live up to its ethical highest and not down to its ethical lowest, and if, third, it will abandon the mental slavery of childish dogma and become intellectually progressive. It should add new beliefs, or alter and adapt its system wherever needed. It must progress parallel with the intellect of man, be on the move with our moving age, and not remain an inflexibly obstinate creed. Some of the more sensible ecclesiastics have already yielded their old crude ideas in surrender to advancing knowledge. But many more are merely parcels of timid conventional superstitions, neatly tied together and adorned with hat, suit and shoes. The very Reverend Inge has not hesitated to advocate bold rational changes in Christian doctrine, while in Africa and Asia, Mohammedan, Hindu and Buddhist divines have done the same to a lesser extent. But until the highest dignitaries boldly promulgate more refined and rational conceptions, a more tenable faith, until they value living ethics above dying history, present trends will injure their obsolete dogmas and, what is worse, injure the moral supports of their devotees. The illusions of their flocks may be excused, but the ignorance or obstinacy of the clerics themselves is unpardonable. The world is in pregnancy with new thoughts. The labor pains of commencing childbirth affect it and the cries that come from it are to be expected. The whole universe is subject to the law of change, all history is but a tale of continuous adaptation to environment, and when the leaders of a religion submit to this law voluntarily their reward will be great in every way. Those who submit at the proper time will be practicing wisdom, those who resist at the wrong time will be practicing foolishness. In an age of advancing education such as ours, religion must voluntarily clear its labyrinth of traditional rubbish and reorganize itself on a more intellectual basis. Mystery and tradition have made the organized religions powerful institutions / science and the spirit of inquiry are unmaking them. Therefore, the last word of counsel from every well-wisher who is not dead to the time spirit nor blind to the world crisis is that religion must grow up with the growing mind of man. The position of an unprogressive religious institution which rigidly rules its adherents, binds them forever to believe in a kindergarten creed, and discourages interest in contemporary knowledge is not different from that of a schoolmaster who, whilst welcoming new pupils to his class, prevents the old ones from passing up to the next higher class and would forever detain them under him in the same class. It ought never to forget its higher purpose, which is to fit the more advanced among its flock for the next higher degree. It will then cease to resent the individualism of mystics but rather delight in their progress. In this way it will best help others and most help itself. Finally, there is plenty of help for religion for the reason that it is needed. If only it will arouse new energies and bravely reconstruct itself. But even if this unlikely event occurs, the ethically dangerous post-war situation will not be fully solved thereby. Many people will still be irrevocably lost to religion, however much it adapt itself. For when ignorant men think that religion is a delusion, they often leap to the false conclusion that morality is a myth. History shows that it has proved disastrous in times of great social change to identify ethics with any special religious creed. When the creed goes, the ethics entangled with it goes too. Whoever cares for the well-being of the race cannot look unconcerned upon this dark prospect. What is to be done? The remedy lies in remembering that those who have caught the modern attitude are not going to yield to ethical exhortations unless these are scientifically based. But is such a basis obtainable? Is a rational ethics available for them which will uplift and not degrade them, and which will supply a sensible motive for well-doing? The answer is that a most reasonable doctrine has long existed in Asia. Unfortunately, it has not kept its pristine purity, but degenerative time has mixed much irrelevant superstition with it, whilst imaginative man has tangled much religious dogma with what is the fundamentally sane and scientific basis of a sound ethical code. The Indian name of this venerable doctrine is karma. The essence of this doctrine is, first, psychological reaction, that is, that habitual thoughts form themselves into tendencies and thus affect our own character. This in turn expresses itself sooner or later in deeds. These, again, not only affect other persons, but also, by a mysterious principle of reaction, ourselves. The working out of this principle implies, second, physical rebirth, that is the persistence of epilogue, the philosophic life thought in the sphere of the unconscious mind, as well as sooner or later the reappearance of more or less the same character or personality upon this earth. Karma creates the need for readjustments and inevitably leads to rebirth, to an outlet for the dynamic factors which have been set in motion. The consequence of this principle is personal retribution, that is, that acts whereby we injure others are inevitably reflected back to ourselves and thus injure us, whereas acts whereby we benefit others eventually benefit us too. This doctrine, like that of mentalism, was discovered by the astute Indian sages through the revealing power of intense concentration of mind, used to sharpen an intelligence devoted to the perplexing problems of the inequality in character and circumstance of human beings. In this manner they came to discern a certain rhythm at work beneath the incessant flux of man's fortunes. There is no such thing as a natural law, in the sense of an arbitrary or authoritative commandment issued by some supreme being. Man makes a law of nature in his thought in order to describe how a particular part of nature behaves. Karma is a perfectly scientific law. It dovetails smoothly into three great scientific discoveries whose verification and proclamation during the 19th century stirred thoughtful men with the tremendous possibilities thus opened up, as well as into two others which have not been so sensational. The first two were, A, the evolution of animal and human forms, B, the conservation or indestructibility of energy. The former brought together all the myriad kinds of species in nature into some kind of scheme of progressive improvement, giving at least a cold justification for the agonizing immolation of the individual upon the altar of its class, whilst the latter brought together the different manifestations of heat, work and chemical power into a simple unified system. Although more modern views have largely modified the original explanation of the method of these processes, and although the how of both still remains much of a mystery, nevertheless their basic principles remain untouched. The evolutionary character of nature's larger changes and the persistence of force still fit better to the known facts of the general universal movement than any other hypotheses. A third scientific teaching which requires mention is that of heredity. The patterns of the fleshly body are inherited ones. If we go farther back in time, we shall find a fourth significant scientific teaching. Newton's third law of motion reveals that for every action there is a reaction, which is equal and opposite. But we are not yet done. For there is a fifth discovery of science, which cannot be overlooked, that all life is ultimately unitary. The universe constitutes a single entity. All the sciences touch each other at some point and none can stand alone. The unity of the universe is the fundamental law of its being. When we bring all these scientific principles into harmony with karma, we find how they analogically support it. The law of evolution reveals that life is a continuation of all that has gone before. We are but links in a long series. We begin as primal molecule and end as complex man. We press towards an unseen goal because we feel the need of completion. We have already traveled a long journey from the planetary mud up to our present day self. But we shall have to travel still farther. For the end of this journey will be the sublime discovery that man is no mere cipher in a statistical census, no mere glorified ape of the jungle, but an unconscious partaker of a blessed and benign reality. The principle of conservation of energy expresses the fact that no energy can be destroyed in the process of its transformations. In the same way, human thoughts and deeds are nothing else than energies which are not destroyed but which reappear in the form of their effects upon others and upon ourselves. They are seeds which sprout eventually into time and space manifestation. Science admits in the doctrine of heredity that everybody has had some kind of existence before birth. Similarly, the mind must have had some kind of existence before birth. The mental characteristics are transmitted ones and can have been derived from a former earthly existence alone. Newton's law of equal return reappears in the world of ethics, where the same sequence holds true. Whatever we do unto others is returned to us in some way and at some time. Life pays us back in our own coin. Karma's deeds find us out one day. The good deeds we do foreshadow the good fortune we shall eventually reap. We get what we give. The unitary character of the whole universe must also include man's life. Any violation of this law of his own being must, by reaction, sooner or later bring its own punishment in the shape of suffering or discord. Any fulfillment of it must equally bring harmony and happiness. Moreover, this same individual unity indicates that rebirth is inevitable because of the continuity of the world process. Because each appearance of life must emerge out of what has somewhere gone before, because the present cannot be sundered from the past. Thus human life becomes, broadly speaking, an education of epilogue, the philosophic life mind, character and capacity. This education develops over long periods of time in a series of related physical re-embodiments, each of which provides appropriate lessons through the experiences and reflections therein generated. All living is learning. All incarnation is education. To take a new body is to take a new seat in life's school. The growth of mind is the true biography of man. All history becomes allegory. Just as a child's understanding of the three R's, reading, writing and arithmetic, constitutes its elementary education in school, so an adult's understanding of these three R's of reaction, rebirth and retribution constitutes his elementary education in the larger school of life. Mentally, the struggles of existence tend first to unfold and then to sharpen reason. Ethically, the notion that whatever seeds we sow we shall reap an appropriate harvest becomes slowly borne in upon us. Technically, ability rises from untrained mediocrity and gradually gets concentrated along special lines until it achieves its culmination in facile and labored genius. The law of karma is the only one which will reasonably account for those blights on existence which must otherwise be accepted as the awful products of mere chance or as the unjust fiats of an arbitrary deity. Without karma we must give up these problems in despair as being pieces in a perfectly insoluble puzzle. The babe helplessly born blind, the child brought up in a squalid filthy slum, the fame-hungry young man who struggles in vain to find a fit outlet for unrecognized ability. The middle-aged woman whose whole life has been wrecked by an unfortunate marriage. The elderly family breadwinner who falls fatally under an automobile. These are the tragedies which make life seem either a hideous game of sheer luck or the unfortunate plaything of a cruel god. Karma, however, puts a more rational face upon these enigmas by turning them into the outcome of wrong acts done previously, either in the same existence or in an earlier fleshly embodiment. Thus it responds to a profound need of the human heart for more adequate justice in life. An imperfect notion of this tenet is that which places the effect of present thoughts and deeds only in future births and remote incarnation. We must impress firmly upon our minds that the consequences of our actions may have to be reaped at any moment here in this birth, that the wrong or right behavior of one incarnation may determine the misery or happiness of the same incarnation, and that there is no necessity to wait for lives yet to come before we can feel the benefits of virtue or pay for the pains caused to others. Karma covers both the present and future births.